This is The Guardian.
European Union is really out of line. UK is out of line, but I'm sure that one, I think that one can be worked out. But the European Union is an atrocity.
No return to the customs union, to the single market, or to free movement. And that remains the case.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. It's been 5 long years somehow since we left the European Union.
Happy Brexitversary!
I spent so much of my time writing about Brexit as well. You know, Brexit wars in Parliament, trips to and from Brussels, all the wrangles over, you know, parliamentary procedure and all the deal, you know, what the Brexit deal would look like. I can't believe 5 years has gone. It's strange. Anyway, to neatly mark the anniversary, Keir Starmer is going to be heading to Brussels later today, attending his first European Council meeting. He won't actually be at the sort of the round the table with other European leaders, but he will be going to the dinner later. And we're told that the focus of the discussion is going to be on defence and security. That's kind of like safe terrain for Starmer to go and talk about the British-European relationship. But it's more than that, isn't it? It's quite a symbolic moment in the overall planned reset.
Yeah, reset. That's a word, by the way, that the Brits like to use about this particular moment in UK-EU relations. But I have to say, the Europeans really don't like. Keir Starmer came in promising this quote-unquote reset, you know, the bilateral relationship between the UK and the EU. The Europeans, however, say, look, we've had our reset. That kind of happened with Rishi Sunak. And when we signed the Windsor Framework, when we, you know, reorganised the deal around Northern Ireland, that was our big reset. Mm. If you want to do anything else, you have to come and convince us to change the arrangements once again.
They keep saying things like the ball's in the UK's court, don't they? I was having lunch a couple of weeks ago with a senior EU diplomat who told me that they do actually regard it as a significant moment. But they say that this whole idea of a reset is significant but not transformative.
Right.
So I think expected to be limited in scope. But what they really are taking from it is that they think that it will open space to rebuild those relationships which were so damaged during the Brexit process. And as this individual put it to me, start to recover from the trauma of Brexit and what it inflicted on relations, and that it would be an evolutionary relationship rather than necessarily one that we should expect, you know, big headlines, big deals on trade or big deals on migration. Mm. Instead, there'll be gentle tweaking around the edges. But if we go 5 years further forward, we'll look back on this moment and think, actually, there has been significant change. And there's another moment of symbolism about the meeting later tonight. It's being held, Kieran, at a place called the Palais d'Egmont, or the Egmont Palace, if you're saying.
Sounds better
English.
In French.
Definitely. Palais d'Egmont, which is where Ted Heath signed the treaty to join the European community in January 1972, so a long time ago. And if you've been there on trips to Brussels in the past, when you walk in, on the hall floor, there's a black stain. And what that black stain is, was an anti-European protester chucking ink over Ted Heath all those years ago, and it was so ingrained, it's still there. So Keir Starmer will be walking past that. A stark reminder of perhaps some of the sort of the conflict and tension back home over all of this.
Watch the red carpet go just to the side of that ink stain so that he could stop and have a look. So it's interesting, though, what you're saying about, you know, European officials briefing that this is going to be an evolutionary process and maybe not one that we'll see one big deal out of. The problem is that we're back in that Brexit period of nothing's agreed till everything's agreed. And that kind of does militate towards having to do big one-off agreements. So let's just talk about a little bit about what each side wants. Obviously, Keir Starmer's red lines here is he doesn't want to go back into the customs union, no return to freedom of movement, no return to the single market. Those are kind of absolutely what the UK is going to stay out of. Obviously, the Europeans will be pushing to see just how red those lines are and how firm the UK is going to be on them, particularly when it comes to a youth mobility scheme, which, as we've talked about before, is one of the big things that Brussels wants, particularly actually Berlin I think, wants from this renegotiation.
Explain what that is.
So the idea is that you would have a scheme for 18 to, let's say, 30-year-olds, although the upper limit would be up for negotiation, to come and study or work for a limited period of time in the UK. And Brits would be able to do the same thing. Some of that, or adjacent to that, perhaps, would be an Erasmus scheme, which is where you get university students going between the two and being charged only the same rate as domestic students. But a lot of it would also be work. And that's what makes Labour politicians, especially Yvette Cooper, as we saw over the weekend, very nervous. That will add to net migration levels.
That's interesting, because people in Downing Street tell me that they would be willing to look at sort of a new Erasmus type scheme for students, but not at the broader, you know, exchange of workers, not least because there's so many more people in Europe who would want to come here, just because the numbers of the people living in the continent than the other way around. So,
but and we've both had this conversation, I know, with similar people high up in the European Commission, where they've said, look, the thing is about the youth mobility scheme is A, we really want it, but B, it's also a test of how willing the UK is to play ball on this. You know, they have to give some ground. Otherwise, why should we give ground? And so Britain obviously wants a couple of things that I've been told should be fairly easy to agree. The first one is a defence and security pact. So that will obviously be discussed today. The second one is an agreement on agricultural goods, a phytosanitary agreement.
Food and animal products.
Yeah, which will be more difficult. You know, you've got to talk about whether we want our food standards to come more in line with European ones, especially when there's pressure from the US to get their agricultural products into the UK. That might be awkward. But, you know, all of that should be agreeable. It's just that the EU is saying, well, fine, if you want to open all this stuff up again, then we have our own asks as well. So you end up just, even if you want to pick bit by bit by bit, the way these negotiations go, you almost always just end up in one big bang agreement whereby, you know, you do everything or you do nothing.
Yeah. And I think Starmer will go into it tonight being very clear that he wants to separate out that this is about trade and security, that this is about the future of Ukraine. And any sort of discussions on the periphery of that about fisheries or anything else are really for another day. But as well as trade and security, the other big area, in fact, the biggest area that I think we're going to be focusing on in the months and years ahead is trade. And yes, as you say, there's been a reiteration of Britain's red lines on not joining a customs union or the single market. And domestically, politically, Starmer's a bit sort of caught between the two poles on that as well, because he's got the Lib Dems on one hand saying, actually, you should go for a customs union. You say that your biggest priority domestically is growth. Well, that would be the single best way of adding a few percentage points onto growth. And the OBR, the government's watchdog on spending, should assess how much value it would add to growth. On the other hand, they've got the Conservatives and much more loudly Reform, saying, oh, we've got all these Brexit freedoms. We're in control of our sovereignty. Why would we want to surrender and, you know, go back and be in hock to the European Union? But it is worth noting, particularly when we're hearing rumbles, and we'll get onto this, rumbles from across the Atlantic from Donald Trump on the latest sort of tariff missiles he might lob over in our direction. The amount of trade we do with the States, China, and the European Union, and the reason why the government is trying to sort of triangulate that relationship. 46% of all UK trade is done with the European Union. Not surprising, it's just over the channel. We've got historical links, compared to 16% with the United States and 7% with China. So all those elements are substantial and, of course, important in our trading relationships, but the EU one is absolutely key.
Wasn't it interesting over the weekend that Donald Trump was talking about how much he liked Keir Starmer and how he might just spare the UK the kind of tariffs that he's about to impose on the EU. He's asked Keir Starmer to do something like settle the budget. And nobody could quite figure out what the US president meant by that. He usually talks about trade deficits. And because the UK doesn't operate a trade deficit with the US, we seem to be being spared some of the action that, you know, Canada and China and Mexico and the EU are being threatened with.
That means we import, obviously, as much as we export to the United States. So it's seen as being more balanced. And as you say, Trump said that he was getting along very well with Starmer, but we'll see whether or not we can balance out our budget.
That's the line, balance out our budget. We're not quite sure what he means with that, about that, because we don't have a trade imbalance with the US in the way that other places do. But obviously, you know, if Keir Starmer does want to go even further and open up more parts of British trade to the US to sign some kind of, I mean, it won't be a full trade agreement, as we've said before, but even sectoral trade agreements, then that just puts pressure on the opposite direction, doesn't it? You know, on food, if you want to do anything, you're probably going to have to lower your standards, not increase them.
And this senior EU diplomat that I saw the other day was making it absolutely clear that should the US hit the European Union with tariffs, which it did last time, and it hit Britain with tariffs last time on steel and whiskey and a few other goods, that they would retaliate in kind with their full economic might. And the European Union collectively is a powerful economic bloc. So I think it all adds into this sort of sense of uncertainty we've had. We're just not quite sure how far Trump is going to go, having imposed tariffs last time he was in power, whether he plans to do it again, or whether it's sort of more of a threat to try and get what he wants. Because even with the announcements of tariffs on Mexico and Canada at 25% and on China at 10% that he announced on Saturday, he still couches it in language like if they can sort out, for example, with Mexico, you know, the migration issue and the amount of fentanyl coming over our borders, then we can talk again. So how much is he trying to get something out of them before tariffs actually imposed and do damage? Because of course they wouldn't just do damage to the Mexican and Canadian economies, they'd also do huge damage to US businesses and whack up prices for US consumers. Yeah. And even if Trump says, well, that's just short-term damage and longer-term be better off the US economy, that is an untested, unproven point.
Yeah, well, he was saying that the US public needed to be ready for some element of pain over the next few months or even years over the weekend, which certainly wasn't the message before the election. But should we move from talking about high, serious international politics to a bit of Westminster gossip?
always.
You know, we pretend not to be interested, but it's difficult to ignore some of the revelations that are coming out in a new book called Get In by the journalists Gabriel Pogrund and Patrick Maguire, who've been looking at the Labour leader's path to power and some criticism of his managerial style. None of the revelations that we've had in a series of stories over the weekend have completely shocked us, in that a lot of it we either knew about or was very much on a par of what we've been hearing. But some of the quotes are...
Beautiful, colourful language, isn't it?
Which
press all journalists' buttons. So some of the extracts from the book published over the weekend claimed that Keir Starmer's chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, had described him as an HR manager, not a leader.
Painful.
And a different unnamed member of his inner circle said, Keir's not driving the train. He thinks he's driving the train, but we've sat him at the front of the DLR. Now, for those of our listeners that aren't in London, one of the fun things that London parents do, myself included, is when we go on the DLR, which is driverless, we encourage our kids to sit right at the front and then they can pretend that they're steering.
Yeah. Same as on the top deck at the front of the London buses. That's the seat for kids. And it seems the leader of the Labour Party. But you've been covering Keir Starmer for longer than I have. I wasn't writing about him while he was in opposition. As I was saying, there's probably not a lot in there that surprises us. But do you think he's changed at all during that period? Is this a kind of accurate picture or is this a slightly outdated picture of what he's been like as Labour leader?
So I think when Keir Starmer first took over, one of the criticisms of him was that he was quite a technocrat and that he was much more interested in the policy than in the politics, that he was focused on sort of, you know, solutions to big problems and really trying to get into the weeds of how they could be resolved. And I think because he was new to politics, I mean, he only arrived in Parliament, don't forget, in 2015, 10 years ago, and previously he'd had a career as a very eminent barrister and then obviously led the Crown Prosecution Service, so was a senior civil servant. He wasn't kind of political to the fingertips in the way that a lot of his then shadow cabinet, now cabinet and advisors are. And so I think there's always been this sort of gap, if you like, between them. They feel that he doesn't really have sort of like the political instincts, at least not ones that he's sure of. And that has led to a series of missteps since he came to office because he's not alive enough to the potential political fallout. I mean, winter fuel was a big one, the freebies row. He was very focused on, well, I've not done anything wrong, not broken any rules, rather than thinking, well, what are the optics? What does this look like to the public and why don't they like it? That's just two of multiple examples. Within his party, there are those who think, actually, you know what, having somebody that can get stuff done and is focused on delivery is the right person, type of person to have. And there are those more political who think, but he needs to be able to tell the story of why he's doing all of this, and he needs to be able to persuade voters that he's not just sort of like, you know, this narrow-minded, focused, quite boring bureaucrat, that he is actually somebody who is capable of big ideas and a vision of the country and winning back their trust. And I think that sort of conflict plays out in real time in his cabinet and actually in Number 10 as well. Now, the Labour Party generally is much more loyal to its leaders than the Tory Party. I mean, the Tory regicide we've seen over the last 5 years, with God knows how many prime ministers we've got through, is unlikely, I think, to happen. There's not going to be a big moment where they oust Keir Starmer. But if things don't improve, and I think everybody in Downing Street, Morgan McSweeney down, recognises that their inheritance was difficult, coming into power after so long was difficult when you don't have the experience, possibly don't have the level of preparation you should have had. Keir Starmer has not had a honeymoon, but he will be, by his own side, have a sort of degree of understanding that it takes time to turn things round. But there are some danger moments ahead, not least, not the local elections this year, but next year, because it'd be the first moment there's a big political test of his abilities rather than sort of, you know, the government side of things. And I think it's probably going slightly too far to say that the vultures are already circling, but there's a lot of people keeping a very close eye and asking themselves privately the question, and by a lot of people, I mean inside Number 10 and in the higher echelons of the Labour Party, and whether Keir Starmer is really the man for the job.
There's a theory that I've heard expressed by Labour Party insiders, and I think that comes through in this book, that actually the person Morgan McSweeney really wants to be in charge of the Labour Party is Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, and that his project, the project, as apparently they called it, will only be complete once Wes Streeting is in charge of the Labour Party. But that, I think, is in the back of a lot of people's minds around Keir Starmer, that there is somebody that some of them would quite like to be in power, maybe even before the next election. Mm. I don't know.
The one thing I know for sure, Kieran, is that there'll be more on this to come. Now, something else to keep an eye on this week is Peter Mandelson's arrival in the US as ambassador. It's finally happening after months of speculation. And this is actually something that you have been getting in touch about. A reminder that we're very keen to receive your emails and happy to talk about any questions or anything you'd like to know about our world at Westminster. And the email address, if you would like to get in touch, is politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com.
So Luke has written in to say, could you maybe talk about Peter Mandelson and the other old new Labour people? Yeah, I know what he means. Old new Labour people in the Starmer ministry, with the other example being the National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell. Why are these appointments being made when there are people with more experience and relevance around to face modern challenges? In particular, the Mandelson appointment to the US seems bizarre. A not-so-modest peer with close links to the EU and to global finance being sent to the USA?
Good question. So I think talking about Mandelson, first of all, and why he's been picked. So we wrote stories at the end of last year when they were still trying to work out who would be taking over from Karen Pearce, the long-standing UK ambassador to Washington. The options initially included David Miliband, the former New Labour foreign secretary, who now runs a big global development charity based in New York, and a woman called Cathy Ashton, Baroness Cathy Ashton, who was an EU commissioner for foreign affairs for a long time and is an expert in all sorts of global issues, was involved in the Balkans and the Middle East and the Iran talks and so on. And of course, Peter Mandelson. And the reason that Peter Mandelson was interesting for people was because he is an incredibly canny political operator. And there was a feeling that in a world where the US is run by someone incredibly unpredictable who doesn't play things by the book, and you never know what he's going to do next, you need somebody that is nimble and skilled enough to be able to respond to those moments when they happen. So Peter Mandelson's name was in the frame for that. But who was going to be picked came down in great part to who was going to win the US election. And when it became clear that the Democrats were not, and that Trump was going to return to the White House, there was a recognition that having somebody that was very close in the way that David Miliband was with people at Hillary Clinton and the Democrat establishment was not necessarily going to be the right answer. And that's why they then settled on Peter Mandelson. Now, he's not a straightforward appointment. As Luke rightly says, there are links with global finance. He was chair of a company which did business with China, for example. And that's something which has kind of spooked some of the Sino-skeptics in British politics. But I think the feeling in Downing Street and the Foreign Office was that any sort of concerns there might be, that if they could actually get him there, and he was accepted by the court of Trump, that he would be best placed to be able to deal with Trump the man, to deal with the Trump administration and to really get to the root of the economic relationship.
Well, I mean, the other element of this, to put a slightly more negative spin on it, is that one thing that has characterized a lot of these appointments, particularly in the foreign policy space in the early months of the Labour government, is a touch of cronyism. You know, Peter Mandelson is a mate. He's very close to Morgan McSweeney. He's kind of been a backer of the Keir Starmer project for a long time, and they felt they owed him a favour. Similarly, when it came to, you know, appointing Jonathan Powell, as Luke says, somebody who's kind of been around those circles for a long time, the previous person who was being lined up to do that job was somebody who'd come up through the army, and Keir Starmer or Sue Gray or Morgan McSweeney or all three of them decided, no, actually, we want a Labour person to be in this job. Now, every government comes in and puts their own people in, and that's fine. But especially when it comes to the American ambassador position, there was someone in place who frankly wanted to stay on, who had good relationships with Trump world. They just decided at some point fairly early on in the process it had to be a Labour person, and they wanted to make a political appointment, which is not normal for that job.
I just think one other thing I'd quickly consider when it comes to some of these appointments to Downing Street in particular. So we've got Jonathan Powell as National Security Advisor, obviously was Tony Blair's chief of staff, Liz Lloyd, who is the political head of the policy unit. She also worked under Tony Blair. Claire Reynolds, political director at Downing Street. She also worked under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. There's a host of them. Is it? I don't think it's just about cronyism, although I take your point about how they feel more comfortable surrounded by people from a similar worldview as them. It's also about experience. And I think one of the things that they realised when they came in is that they needed more heavyweights in there. And the first few months, some of those problems that were encountered by the new government was because they didn't have enough depth, breadth of experience in Downing Street. They needed some big heavy hitters. It was also, I think, because after 14 years in power, there's very few people at the top of government that have ever been inside government and done things like run budgets or spending reviews or dealt with the national security issues. And that played itself out in a negative sense, I think, over the first 6 months. So there's a recognition that they needed to power up Downing Street, a process that they're still carrying on with. They've got more appointments to come in the next few weeks.
Well, look, thanks to Luke for getting in touch. That was really interesting. And do please keep your messages coming in. As Pippa said before, you can email us at politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com. And if you're enjoying listening to Politics Weekly, please leave us a comment or review wherever you're listening. It does help more people to find us.
That's all we've got time for, but please do like and subscribe to Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Zoe Hitch. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.